Welcome back to iGen Politics. This is a podcast that makes politics engaging and relevant for all generations. This is Victor Shi.
And I'm Jill Wine Banks. And today's hashtag Jill's Pin is an old-fashioned movie television camera with actual film reels attached to it. And that's because we have a very exciting Hollywood guest today.
President Biden is back. In the last week, he has been leading in at least five polls released, which is causing many to believe that perhaps that fiery, strong, and energetic State of the Union speech he gave had a positive impact on how people view the message he is delivering and him as the messenger and nominee of the Democratic Party. Today, we are going to ask our guest about messaging and what Democrats must do to win big this November, both at the presidential level and down ballot.
And that guest is Billy Ray, an Emmy Award-winning writer for The Hunger Games and so much more. He also wrote The Comey Rule, as well as numerous other films, including Color of Night, Captain Phillips, and Shattered Glass, all really great films. Billy also is heavily involved in politics and is advising more than 80 Democratic candidates on messaging and strategy. He also hosts Deadline's podcast called Strike Talks, which is reportedly the highest rated podcast in Hollywood's Deadline family of 13 podcasts. Who better than a Hollywood writer to help with messaging? We are very grateful for Billy to be with us today. And we thank you, Billy, for joining iGen Politics today.
It is a privilege to be asked.
Well, we're so glad, and this came about because I saw you last week at a Jewish deli, and so it's great to have this conversation with you here. As we're recording this, President Biden right now is ahead in at least five polls after the State of the Union, and we wanted to ask you as a writer what you think about sort of the messaging of that event, the exact right words so an audience understands and feels the message as intended, and sort of if you thought the tone and the pointed contrast between his agenda and MAGA extremists was the right one.
I do. And I think it was also true last year at the State of the Union. 65% of Americans don't think they matter. They don't think they matter to their families. They don't think they matter to their communities. They don't think they matter to our collective future as Americans. And that need to matter is primal. We come out of the womb needing to matter. If that need is not met, society crumbles. What Biden does so well is he keeps telling people that they matter and that they matter to him specifically. He makes the American worker the hero of every story. And I think that's why it resonates.
That's such an interesting insight. And I'm going to divert for a second because I once had a conversation with the chief of police who was talking about why gangs are so successful. And it's because they make their members believe that they matter, that there are rules, and that there are consequences for breaking the rules. And that's the same thing you're saying. So is there anything you would have improved in President Biden's delivery or his content?
No, I thought he knocked it out of the park. I mean, he generally does. One of the things that I've noticed about the mainstream media is that in an effort to make everything look more cliffhangery than it actually is, they keep trying to tear the guy down so that the election will seem close. I don't think that it actually is, to be honest with you. I don't think we're a divided country. I don't think we're close to divided. I mean, as a matter of fact, when they put minimum wage on the ballot in Florida, it got 60%. They put it on ballot in Arkansas, it got 62%. They put it on the ballot in Missouri, it got 67%. This core Democratic idea in states where Democrats always get their asses kicked. Two-thirds of the country was with us on minimum wage. Two-thirds of the country is with us on abortion and on not wanting government-mandated pregnancy. Two-thirds of the country is with us on guns, on protecting Social Security, on protecting Medicare, on the environment, on decriminalizing cannabis, on all the things that matter. Two-thirds of the country is with us. We are not a divided country. If Democrats can learn how to get out of their own way on cultural issues, elections won't be close.
So what are we doing wrong then? I mean, you're right. When you're individually polled on the issues that Democrats stand for, the country is with the Democratic position. And yet yes, they're not voting that way. And certainly because of the Electoral College, we aren't winning all the races we should win at the presidential level.
It's true. But in 2016, there were 6.2 million Americans who had voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, called flip voters. 1.3 million of them were in three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, which is why the blue wall crumbled. So somebody very smart did a deep dive on those 1.3 million voters. Why had they flipped in the way that they had? And here's what they found out. On average, those 1.3 million voters in those three states work 2.5 jobs. They commute 3 hours a day, and they think about politics 4 minutes per week. Per week.
Wow.
So you're not going to get them on an argument about the filibuster or the debt ceiling. They don't care. It's got nothing to do with their life. You go up to that voter in Eau Claire, in Lansing, what have you. Again, he's working 2.5 jobs. He's commuting 3 hours a day, and he's thinking about politics 4 minutes per week. I guarantee you he's taking his medication every other day to make 30 pills last 60 days. His kid's school is falling apart. His mom's in a nursing home, if he's lucky. And Americans consume 80% of the opiates in the world. So throw that in there too. You go up to that guy and say, you've got white privilege and I don't like your pronouns. He's going to tell you to go screw yourself, and he's going to go running into the arms of the nearest Republican. But we as Democrats insist that people celebrate things that they have just learned how to tolerate. And that's not the same thing, okay? Because if you were to say to that guy gay rights, he'd say, okay, I don't care. I know a gay guy, he works in HR. He's fine and I'm fine. But don't tell me if I don't march in a parade, I'm a homophobe, right? But Democrats say to them, if you don't come all the way with us, you're a knuckle dragger and we're gonna cancel you. And that's how we lose them. And that's how we don't get them back. If you were to poll any American in any house race in America, they all tell you the same thing. The Republican was an asshole. And the Democrat was an elitist. And the asshole never made me feel dumb. That's the only way we lose. The only way.
Thank you for saying that. I want to take a quick break in the recording just to ask you, I don't know if you saw that Victor and I wrote an op-ed together about the State of the Union, where we were sort of arguing for a new format and a new way of presenting it and using social media. If you haven't had a chance to see it, we aren't going to ask about whether you agree that some of our suggestions would have worked. We'll just skip right ahead.
I did not have a chance to see it, but if you want to recommend it to me as if the article hasn't yet been written, I'm happy to talk about it.
Okay, we could sort of ask some just broad general questions about it.
Okay.
Sure, and I just want to follow up on that idea of the cultural issues, if I could just continue for a second.
Yeah, definitely, because okay? You were going great on that. I loved everything you were saying.
Okay, so are we recording?
Yeah.
Okay, so the way that it expresses itself in most people's lives is that they think we're saying to them, oh, no, you can't say pregnant women anymore. You got to say pregnant persons, which makes us sound insane. And they think that we're saying, oh, no, you can't say breastfeeding. You got to say chest feeding, which makes us sound even crazier. Okay. Remember that for most people, their experience of government is the HR person in their office who basically tells them they can't look, breathe, or smile the way that they're used to. And they think of that as a democratic idea. They think that we are telling them how to talk, which again goes back to this idea of you don't matter.
Right.
And every time we tell them that they don't matter, they go running into the arms of the nearest Republican.
Great point. If we can, I just want to let you know that Victor and I wrote an op-ed for MSNBC about the State of the Union address. And it was basically sort of our being brazen in giving advice to the President of the United States, who doesn't, of course, need our advice. He has great advisors. But we had some ideas that we thought would broaden the audience and make people feel heard and cared about in the same way you're talking about, that it would make people really absorb the message. And Victor, why don't you talk about some of the points we made and see if Billy, who's much more expert at this than we are, thinks that any of these could help in future State of the Unions or even future speeches anywhere.
Well, the premise of the op-ed was really taking what I think a lot of people consider this sort of insidery DC high production event that only gets to, you know, people who watch cable news and traditional media outlets, and expanding it to a newer media market, whether it's social media, you know, enlisting influencers and surrogates to then spread that message out there, you know, even changing the format of the State of the Union, whether it's through people speaking about their stories and how the president's policies have impacted them. And so we were just sort of thinking about the changes that can be done to an event like the State of the Union that traditionally doesn't reach that younger and newer audience. And we would love to sort of hear your thoughts on how you think that we can make these presidential speeches that traditionally or used to have, I think, a large impact on society generally, whereas now it's sort of just with all our fragmented media is becoming harder.
I think that's a good idea. And I think like so much of what Biden does, it just needs to be produced a little bit better.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, if someone said to me, how do you get more people to watch the State of the Union? I remember when I was a kid, when ABC did the Olympics, they used to do this thing called Up Close and Personal, where they would take you into the story of the athletes back home and how they got to the Olympics. And so that when they were lined up at the starting line, you thought, oh my God, I know their story. This is amazing. They have to win.
Right.
I think you could do that for the president. I would like to see, before he just shows up in House of Representatives to deliver that speech, I would have done, you know, 2 days before, I would have been releasing clips of him with people around him writing the speech and talking about what's important and letting us see why he's saying what he's saying. And then, to be honest with you, I would show the bad guys too. Every story needs a bad guy. So I would do a behind the scenes on the Republicans and how they're crafting their response and the incredible cynicism and dishonesty and I think perjury that goes into that kind of response. I mean, that would have been awesome to see how Senator Britt came up with the idea of doing that response in her kitchen. I would love to have that one on film, so that you know, like, who's Rocky and who's Apollo Creed walking into the ring.
Her response was one that didn't even need to be parodied because it looked like it was a Saturday Night Live skit, although they did a good job with it. They did a good job, but man, that was, it was your mouth hung open going like, I can't believe they thought this was a good idea. It's insane.
Yeah, but well, okay. This is, again, what I'm saying. This party is in free fall, the Republican Party. They have... They are so wedded to this anvil, and they don't know how to escape it, and so they're all in, and they're going to go down with that ship, and people like Senator Britt are going to lead the way.
So let's dive deeper into sort of how Democrats should be messaging generally, because I think anyone who's listened to you up to this point probably knows the genius of your messaging strategy. So how should Democrats be crafting their messages specifically in this election cycle and some of the issues they should be focusing on?
I've been studying this since the day Trump was elected, and I realized that my future happiness and mental health literally hinged on stopping him. That I was not going to survive if that guy had unchecked power for a million reasons. And what I've realized is that all elections come down to two things. What do people want and what are they afraid of? That's really everything. And if you can get underneath the hood and understand that, you can make the engine run right. Okay, so let's look at the voters that matter, which are undecided independents. That's roughly 25%. Of independents right now that are still movable one way or another. They tend to lean conservative and they tend to be cranky. So Democrats need to find a new language. They need to speak in a new kind of frequency, because the frequency that Democrats typically speak in can be heard by liberals, but cannot be heard by conservatives. Literally, they're like dogs that can't hear in certain waves. To reach them, you have to understand what it is that they're afraid of. What is it that they don't want? conservative minds psychologically, what makes a conservative on a psychological level, what binds them together as a political group, is their shared fear of chaos. That's what we represent to them. That's what they have been, that's what every Republican has been running on for as long as I've been alive. The Willie Horton ad that buried Michael Dukakis in 1988 essentially said, if you vote for Michael Dukakis, a black convict on furlough is going to come murder your family. Okay, Democrats are soft on crime, chaos. And then after 9/11, it became Democrats are soft on terror, chaos. Now the argument is Democrats are for open borders, Democrats are for burning cities, Democrats want to defund the police, Democrats don't care if your son becomes your daughter. Chaos, chaos, chaos. If you give a conservative the choice between authoritarianism and what they perceive to be chaos, they'll pick authoritarianism every time. They're doing it right in front of us. So we, as Democrats, must redefine ourselves as the antidote to chaos, which means we have to rebrand what chaos is. Chaos is people showing up at polling places with AR-15s. Chaos is January 6th. Remember when there were 30 cars backed up in that rural hospital parking lot because Trump didn't have an answer for COVID? That's chaos. We just want to govern. We're the people who, when the I-95 collapses and everyone says it'll take a year to rebuild, we rebuilt it in 16 days. That's what we do. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We are just trying to take care of the big stuff so that you're free to live your best life and get your kids to school on time. That's the message.
Fast forward to the end of 2024 and think of your goals. What can you do right now to make sure you succeed? If you want to learn a new language, you should absolutely get Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't help you speak the language.
And we have an answer if you really want to know how to speak. And I love using Babbel. One of my goals has been for a long time to relearn a language that I learned in college. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are the perfect way to do it. They're crafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations with tips and tools that you can use for conversation-based teaching to be approachable, accessible, and rooted in real-life situations. You can use what you've learned in the real world in no time. And I just came back from Cuba, and I was really sorry that I was studying French, because I know if I had just taken a few weeks' worth of Babbel lessons, I would have been so much better off in Cuba.
And now that I'm in the real world as a college graduate, I think Babbel takes on a new importance in my life. I want to go to new restaurants. I want to go to new countries. I want to travel the world. And so Babbel really, I think, is the best tool and app out there for me to do that, to have conversations with people, whether it be at restaurants or in different countries. Now that I don't have to go to classes anymore, I can take Babbel on my phone and it'll be my professor right there.
You're going to love it. And let me just tell you, there's a lot of places in America where if you go, like Florida, you will want to have studied Babbel's Spanish lessons.
Yes.
Babbel has speech recognition technology, which definitely improves pronunciation for anyone, including me with a big Chicago accent. Here's what it's like.
Oui.
Oui.
No.
No. It liked how I said it. I got a check mark.
Merci.
Merci.
Salut.
Salut.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Studies from Yale, Michigan State, and others continue to prove that Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. You need to try it.
And to encourage you to try it, here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, you can get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/iGen. You can get 55% off at babbel.com/iGen, spelled babbel.com/iGen. Rules and restrictions may apply. You can also start your language adventures with the link in our show notes. I want to follow up on what you just mentioned about the bridge collapse, because we had a chance to have a text exchange with you before we started recording, and you had a great thought about how the messaging about the bridge collapse could be something that would really make all voters realize what Democrats were, what they stood for. And so I wanted to ask you to delve more into the three words that you said would help message about that and describe it a little more, because it was really brilliant.
Well, that's a big word for it, but rescue, rebuild, reopen. That's what you do, okay? This is a chance for Democrats, that's a Democrat-controlled state, show America. This is how we do it, right? We're not going to politicize anything. We're just going to put on our hard hats and go to work. Yeah. Rescue, rebuild, reopen, and watch what happens.
I think it's
this time when we do it, take a few goddamn pictures in front of it so that you can use it as campaign fodder until November, because these are the sort of opportunities that Democrats, for some reason, are so good at fixing and so bad at messaging.
And the way to vote should be on the governing and the fixing. And I love that you had these three words that sort of reminded me of brilliance of Republican messaging, where they adopted this "Make America Great Again," which means nothing. And America already, I mean, it was nonsense, but it was like a phrase that just stuck. And for me, rescue, rebuild, and reopen is one that would stick. And President Biden did today have a press conference at which he said, our first priority is rescue. And of course it is. And then he said, and then we, the federal government, will pay for the complete rebuild. And someone said to him, well, isn't the shipping company responsible? They did it. And he said, we'll pay for it now to get it done so that it can reopen. He didn't know that you had already said this. Unless maybe he did. Maybe you're communicating with him. But he did exactly say, but he didn't use those words. And so I think we need to start putting on social media a hashtag for those words, because it is exactly what Democrats will do.
We could totally see a shirt. I mean, maybe we'll get that started. Rescue, rebuild, reopen. To Jill's point, if I can add a follow-up question to that, you know, one of the things to her point about Republican messaging that I find fascinating and scary is that they're able to take these really sort of meaningless and hollow words and turn it into something that sticks with their voters. And I'm wondering, I mean, to your point about rescue, rebuild, reopen, other sort of potential catchphrases or simple words or phrases that could sort of change people's minds about specific issues or about President Biden generally?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, you know, if I were evil, I would have been the greatest Republican strategist of all time. because Republicans, they are message discipline warriors.
Yes.
And when you tell them something like build the wall, they just go do it. By the way, the reason that build the wall worked is because conservatives like walls around things. They like borders around things. They like borders around countries. They like borders around gender. They like borders around sexuality. So build the wall tracked in the same way that lock her up tracked. Republicans tend to pitch very simplistic solutions to very complex problems, which make for great bumper stickers. Okay, so here are a few things that I think Democrats should do. First of all, on guns. Okay, if you talk about universal background checks, you are speaking to a group of people who are already suspicious of a strong central government. And that sounds like something Big Brother would do, universal background checks. You know, if you change that terminology to violent history checks, 95% of America comes with you, 95, including 73% of NRA members. So let's say violent history checks instead of universal background checks. Start there. Then when you talk about the environment, climate change just scares the crap out of people. They don't know what it means, they just know that it's scary. But if you talk about climate rescue, all of a sudden it sounds like you have a plan. and all politics are aspirational. So let's talk about climate rescue. And when you're talking about abortion, stop using the word abortion. You know, we had to defend that damn thing for 50 years. And it was an anvil around all of our necks. All of a sudden, they have to defend government-mandated pregnancy. So let's talk about that. You know, that woman in Texas, that was government-mandated pregnancy. She didn't want to have that kid. She wasn't ready to have that kid. But the government was mandating that she have it. So let's talk about that. In every way possible, let us break the frame. When we are invited into a conversation that's a trap, reject the premise of the question. You don't have to answer it just because it was asked. It's ridiculous. That's nonsense. That's like, you know, when I was a kid, people used to make that joke. Actually, skip that part.
Go ahead with
but
that.
The point is, no, it's okay. It's okay. It was one of those things that you would say in the 70s that you wouldn't say anymore. So please edit that part out.
Okay.
But anyway, the point is that whenever we allow Republicans to dictate the terms of the debate, we're going to sink every time. And it's unnecessary. Like, for example, when Biden was out there talking about Build Back Better, there was a phrase out there, working for working people, that polled 25 points higher. 25 points.
Really?
Why did we stick with Build Back Better?
Yeah.
I mean, I happen to know this because I thought up working for working people, and I went to a pollster and I said, could you please go poll this against Build Back Better? And they did. And it outpolled it by 25 points.
Wow.
Well, I understand you're working for a lot of Democrats now. I hope that number expands and that they follow your advice. But let's go back to some of the specific issues. I mean, you mentioned our three top ones that we wanted to ask about, but another one is the issue of Israel and Gaza. And
sure.
Particularly, Victor and I have this conversation because, of course, this is an intergenerational podcast, but Gaza and Israel don't have the same meaning to Victor's generation that they do to my generation.
No.
And so what is the way to message on what needs to be done to protect Israel, to protect civilians in Gaza, and to make it make sense to particularly young people?
To me, the bottom line is that the Palestinian people cannot be safe if Hamas is in power. That to me is the simplest message possible. Like, just take Israel out of the equation for a second. And I say this as someone who is Jewish and was raised Jewish. I think Netanyahu is a crook. I think he may very well be a war criminal on top of everything else. That guy should not be in power. And so you can be Jewish and be highly critical of Israel, and you can be highly critical of Israel and not be an anti-Semite. But there is this incredibly reductive and very binary idea that gets spread on college campuses, which is an outgrowth of identity politics, yeah. Which is that everybody is either the oppressor or the oppressed, and that there's no gray in between. And if you went to an American university in the last 10 years, you were taught that Israel's the oppressor and the Palestinians are the oppressed, and you will identify with the oppressed, even if you're Jewish. And I've spoken to a number of 20-year-old kids of Jewish friends of mine who are anti-Zionists now, because they have totally bought into this idea of the oppressor and the oppressed. Well, the fact is, it's more nuanced than that. It's vastly more complicated than that. And there is wrong on both sides. But the first thing that is universally true is that Hamas must be taken out of power. It is the only hope for the Palestinian people.
You know, it's not only the hope for the Palestinian people, but Israel cannot survive if Hamas is allowed to continue, because I read a meme that said, if the Arabs, meaning Hamas, lays down their arms,
yeah, right,
there will be peace. If Israel does, there will be no Israel. And so I think there has to be some way to get young people to realize that this is an existential threat to Israel to have Hamas.
I don't agree really? Because I don't think they care. I don't think on most college campuses you will get far with the argument that Hamas must be neutralized in order to save Israel. But if you make the argument that Hamas must be neutralized in order to save Palestinians, I think you'll get much farther.
Interesting.
Good point. And,
it's a great point. And I think to your point, I mean, there is this conversation does also seem to be happening, especially on elite college campuses, the top of the top. And it's not an issue that I think is actually being discussed all that much on, you know, in rural Iowa or in Wisconsin. But I wanted to ask you more about your point about the frame, because last week when we got together, we talked about that concept of establishing a frame. Can you talk more about that, what it means, and maybe a few examples of how Democrats can establish that frame in communication and messaging?
Sure. Breaking the frame means rejecting the premise of the question. In 2002, 2003, when W wanted to invade Afghanistan and Iraq, he sent Dick Cheney out on every Sunday morning talk show to defend it. And on every Sunday morning talk show, Cheney got asked the same question, which is, what's the cost going in terms of men, material, and money? And every single time, Cheney broke the frame. He said, what's the cost of not going? Right? Because had he answered the question, it would have been, well, I think we'll be there 20 years. I think we're going to spend $7 trillion, and I think we're going to lose 5,000 American lives. And then he would have lost, which would have been better, but he broke the frame. Now, conversely, go to October 7th, 2016, the Access Hollywood tape is discovered. A couple days later, Hillary's debating Trump. The first question's about the tape. She does 90 seconds on sexual predators, which changed nobody's mind. Imagine if she had broken the frame. Imagine if her answer had been, I'm not gonna comment on the Access Hollywood tape. The world can make up its own mind about Donald Trump, because my focusing on that tape won't get one of you a job. It won't get one of you healthcare. It won't clean one river or build one school. And that's what my administration's about. That's what I'm just doing on 90 seconds on. She wins by 10 points, but she just couldn't or wouldn't do it. It's hard for fair-minded people to break the frame, because people feel that if they're asked a straight question, they are duty-bound to deliver a straight answer. But in politics, that's not true. In that business, like in my business, if you're explaining, you're losing. So the most important thing when you're asked a question that's an obvious trap is to turn it around and make it a problem for the person who asked the question, not a problem for you. So, for example, if you're a Democrat and you're running against a Republican, oh, let's just pull something out of thin air named Ted Cruz. And in a debate, he tells a lie about you. You don't defend yourself. You don't set the record straight. You say, Ted, this state, Texas, is facing some pretty serious problems, as our country is. And I think we can solve them if we deal with them in a serious way. We're not going to solve them by lying about my record. So you need to stop that. And then when Ted does it again, you say, Ted, we talked about this. I mean, as you know, the job of being a senator is about serving the people of the state. You don't serve them by lying about my record. So you need to stop this. And then when he does it a third time, you say, Ted, I'm starting to think you've got a listening problem. So while you're over there dancing by yourself in fiction land, I'm going to be over here dealing with the things that people actually care about, which are inflation and the cost of prescription drugs and the quality of our schools and all the things that Democrats are trying to focus on all day long. When you're ready to join the big boy conversation, we'll be here. Come on by.
Wow. Billy, if you haven't written a book of advice, you should, because I'm serious. I mean, Mehdi Hasan wrote a book about how to win every argument. What you've just said encapsulates much more than that. And is really, it's like, I want every candidate to have that advice and to have someone in their ear. You should train.
Well,
trainers.
I do. And, there are like 85 sitting members of the House and Senate that I do messaging for, and another 30 candidates that are running in the cycle. And I do it one-on-one with them, and then they go out and they execute.
Oh, good.
I'm feeling relieved. I hope you're doing it in all the places with all the really narrow margins where we really need it. And,
Here's what happens. Okay. Here's what happens. They, it used to be that, they would reach out to me because they needed fundraising. Mm-hmm. And I would say to them, okay, I'll fundraise for you. But first, you got to sit down with me for 40 minutes so I can talk to you about how to sound less like a Democrat, how to make arguments that independent voters can actually hear. And that's how I built it, like literally candidate by candidate. That started in 2017. And so by election night of 2018, that midterm, I was working with 30 Democrats running in red districts. And that meant speech writing or debate prep or rapid response or whatever they needed. And of those 30, 21 of them won that night, which was thrilling. I can't take credit for those wins. They were great candidates, but I know that in some of the close races, you know, we've helped. And so it all built from there. And so now candidates or their advisors will reach out and say, can you talk to my guy or my girl? And I get to talk to them about the same issues. And as long as they have a comms person on the Zoom to take notes, it goes pretty well.
That's incredible. That's amazing. And I you're making me want to move to, like, you are a writer, and you write screenplays that are extremely successful. And I'm just wondering, first of all, how you ended up in a career in writing, but whether everything you do for movies translates into what you advise politicians about communicating. Because really, and you know, one thing you said hurts me to the quick, which is, because of my legal training, when I'm asked a question, I feel like I must answer that question. I was trained that when a judge interrupts you, you don't say, well, I'll get to that eventually. You stop and you answer that question. And I, on TV, I have to not do that. I have to be doing what you're saying. But so let's go back to that about how you got into this and whether writing for scripts translates into writing for political messaging.
It absolutely does, because when you are writing a movie, you're trying to locate the audience emotionally. You're trying to get them where you want them to be. I mean, screenwriting is an intellectual exercise, but it's designed to elicit an emotional response. If I write a script and I give it to a friend and a friend says, this is the smartest script I've ever read, I have failed 1,000% because I'm hitting them in their head instead of in their gut. And people don't watch movies with their head. They watch it with their gut. Like, you have to care. You have to really want Chief Brody to catch the shark. You have to really want Dorothy to make it out of Oz. Otherwise, you're just curious as opposed to invested. Well, politics works the same way. You know that old phrase, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. You have to move them. And that means you've got to locate where they are emotionally, figure out the key strings to pull to get them where you want them to be, and then pull them. And it's storytelling. Like everything else in the world, it's storytelling. And it's stunning to me how many members of Congress are crappy storytellers. I just don't understand it in any way, because I think it's so fundamental, not only to getting elected, but to swaying other members so that you can get things passed and make a difference in the world. You have to tell a story. And when Biden is allowed to do that, like the State of the Union, it's a masterclass. And when we set the stage for him properly, he delivers.
One of the things, I mean, to that point, I want to ask you about more about storytelling and some techniques that maybe you have or tips you have to improve written and spoken communications. Because so much, I mean, we both know that you went to UCLA. I just graduated from UCLA. And one of the things that I've noticed, especially in sort of academic writing and the way that writing is taught, is there's not much emphasis on that sort of storytelling aspect. It's very, you know, analytical, and it's very sort of ivory tower-esque. What tips do you have to get people to sort of get to that point of improving storytelling and hooking people in?
Yeah, you start with what we call the fire in the basement or the shark in the water. What's the problem? Identify what is the thing, how has nature been knocked out of balance? And why does that matter? And then who it's affecting, so that we understand, literally, Chrissy Watkins just got eaten by a shark, right? Or Dorothy's house just got picked up by a tornado. We understand what the problem is. Yeah. And now we are invested in the solution of that problem.
Right.
And that's storytelling.
Yeah.
So in terms of not just storytelling, but in terms of, I would say, long-term planning, I think I have observed on things like Roe, Dobbs, IVF, the courts, the Republicans are better at that. I mean, there's also a stereotype that they're better at messaging. And you mentioned that they are lockstep. Once they get a message, they stick with it. But let's talk about the sort of the long-term planning. And do you think that it's true that the Republicans are doing a better job and the Democrats need to start focusing on some of the long-term consequences and how to get to where they need to be, you know, whether it is a national abortion protection or whatever?
I do. I think that Republicans are better suited to messaging because I don't think they're terribly creative. And so when they hear build the wall, they don't look for something better. They just say, oh, build the wall, great. And they go off and do it. Whereas Democrats always think they can come up with something better on their own. And so you give them a piece of messaging and they think, oh, let me put my own personal spin on this. And they water it down and they fuck it up completely. But it's an expression of their creativity. So I can't get too angry at it. I just wish they wouldn't do it. But anyway, in answer to your larger question, the percentage of Americans that really understand how American politics work is stunningly low, like stunningly low. So it is tough to get big picture ideas past Americans. The day after January 6th, I wrote to my 85 sitting members of the House and Senate that I do messaging for. And I said to them, please do not call it a coup. Do not call it an insurrection. No one in America can get their brains around that idea. It is a meaningless concept to people. Just call it a crime. Everybody knows what that is. Everybody knows what a workplace lockdown is. Everybody knows that if you're in your office and a crowd of crazy people are coming and you have to barricade the door with a 300-pound safe, which happened on January 6th, everybody knows that's bad. Everybody knows trespassing is bad. Everybody knows assault of police officers is bad. Everybody knows defacing public property is bad. Just call it a crime. People can get that. People can understand that. It's a small picture idea. But what do Democrats do? We go out and we start doing the rhetoric about the temple of democracy and, you know, all of our bullshit, which is totally true, but which is horrible politics. Horrible. You have to meet people where they live. You cannot expect them to rise to your level of understanding of government, just like you can't expect them to rise to your level of empathy. You just can't. All you're going to do is condescend and make them feel dumb, which is going to make them feel resentful. So that's a big frame for taking every issue and boiling it down to its essence. If I were running against someone, oh, let me pull a name out of thin air, Ted Cruz, and I wanted to talk about government-mandated pregnancy, what I would say is, listen, this is a hard one. This is an issue on which I completely respect the sincerity of people who disagree with me. If you think life begins at the moment of conception, of course you're against abortion. How dare you not be? We disagree about that, but I'm not going to question your sincerity. And if my 20-year-old unmarried niece were pregnant, I don't know what advice I would give her. I really don't. All I know is I don't want Ted Cruz coming into her bedroom and making that decision for her. Okay? That's a really specific visual idea. Ted Cruz standing at the foot of that woman's bed. Right? And if I were debating, let me pull a name out of thin air, Ted Cruz, about this issue, I would say, Ted, I need you to take my 90 seconds on this one because I don't understand it as policy. I just don't get it. How does government mandated pregnancy work? Let's go back to my 20-year-old unmarried niece. She's pregnant. Okay, too late to have a conversation with her about abstinence. And she's not equipped on any level to have this baby, but the state of Texas and the United States government needs her to have this baby. I can't raise it. So I need you to tell me, how is government mandated pregnancy going to work? Okay. If she tries to leave the state of Texas, are we going to stop her at the border? Is that what the policy says? Are we going to have a group of police following around young women and tracking their menstrual cycles? Is that how this is going to work? So are we creating a new layer of police bureaucracy? If so, how are we paying for it? And if we're paying for it, how many bridges aren't we going to build? How many schools aren't we going to build? Which is ironic, because the kid's going to move to school. Oh, okay. So you're saying we're not going to create a new level of police bureaucracy. We're going to take existing police and pull them out of the line and have them follow young women to make sure they don't get the healthcare that they seek. Okay. How many murders aren't they going to investigate because they're following my niece around? How many robberies aren't they going to prevent? Tell me how this is going to work. And then Ted Cruz would say, well, the sanctity of love of police, you know, Ted, I didn't ask you to defend it. I asked you to explain it as policy. You're a senator, you know, it's not just you can't do this, it's what's the policy? How are we paying for the enactment of that policy? What are the rules of the road now of government mandated pregnancy? Ted, what's in the policy? What's in the law that you would support? Because I can say what's in the law that I would support. I could write it for you right now and I can defend it. Go ahead, Ted, take my 90 seconds.
Right.
What's he going to say?
I hesitate to give this example now because I'd be curious as to whether you think I did the right thing. When I was offered the job of Solicitor General of the state of Illinois, I put a caveat on it, which was that I would not argue any case, should it ever happen, that limited abortion rights in Illinois. And my boss, who was a very observant Catholic, was definitely against abortion. And then I made it my mission to try to change his mind. And what I finally came up with, with the help of Sarah Weddington, who had argued Roe and had been an advisor to President Carter after that, I argued that his daughter had been raped. And he said, well, there's a thing that Catholics allow immediately after that wouldn't be considered abortion. I said, she was raped and knocked unconscious and left until after that period of time arose. And she was, what would you do for your own daughter? And that was what got him, was his picturing his daughter pregnant through rape and not able to get whatever the procedure was that would be within Catholic theology. And he changed his view, at least as to what he would impose on other people. And was that the kind of thing that gets to people, it gets to him feeling it as a real risk to himself?
I think in that case, it's absolutely the right way to argue it, because you're talking one-to-one. But if you're talking one to a 5,000, okay, then I would make the approach that's less about empathy and more about policy. Because if you want to reach conservatives, you don't actually get them on the level of empathy. It's not that they lack empathy. They have empathy. It's in a hierarchy of values. It's just lower for them. So the arguments that work with a conservative are about the robustness of the community as a whole. So if I were in a room with 5,000 conservatives, I would make the arguments I just made about, explain to me how it works. I'm open to it. Just tell me how it works. Like, what does it look like? How are we paying for it? What are the cops doing? What's the rule? If she won't eat, are we force feeding her? If she keeps trying to leave the house to get to a doctor, are we chaining her to the bed? What is it going to say in the law? You have to lay that stuff out. So that would be where I'd start. And then I'd say, by the way, did you know that 60% of the women in America who seek abortions already have a kid? Did you know that? Because it just so happens these are not embryo killing monsters. They're mothers who want to do a better job with the kid they already have. So knowing that, and knowing that women who are denied an abortion in America are 4 times more likely to slip below the poverty line, what are we going to do with all these moms and all these kids? I'm not going to let them starve in the streets. It's not America. Okay, Where's the money coming from to take care of these moms who just wanted to be better moms in the first place? How's it going to work? Take me through it. If you can convince me that it works, okay, I'm in. Yeah. Who's got a plan? Because I guarantee you the 5,000 people won't have one. There is no plan. And by the way, can we talk about guns for a second?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. There's a similar argument to be. All Americans, on what values mean the most to them? Freedom is number one, and it's not close. Freedom outpolls justice as a virtue in America by 22 points, which comes no shock to any African American who for hundreds of years has been saying justice, justice, and white America has been saying, well, yeah, justice, it's important. But what I really want is the freedom to say stupid shit and not be called rape. Okay? The second that guns stopped being a safety issue and started being a freedom issue, it was over. You could walk into Sandy Hook and shoot 20 kids, and it didn't change the law, right? In the same way that when masks and vaccines stopped being a health issue and started being a freedom issue, everything got really, really weird, right? Okay, so when you are talking to a room full of conservatives about guns, all they're thinking about is freedom. Democrats never get this. These people are afraid you're coming to take their guns. They keep saying it over and over again. Trump keeps repeating it over and over again. It's unbelievably untrue. But that's what they believe, okay? So if I were running for office against, let me pull a name out of thin air, Ted Cruz, and I was in a room full of Texas Republicans, what I would say to them about guns is, you people are not the problem. You are responsible gun owners. You practice gun discipline. You train. You teach your kids the rules. You stow your weapons safely. I'm not worried about you. Own 10 guns. Own 20, own 50. God bless you. Where I need your help is with people who are not responsible gun owners, who don't practice gun discipline, because those people can get your kid killed in a school, in a mall, in a parking lot, in a church, in a movie theater. And before a political hack like my opponent, Ted Cruz, tells you that we have no common ground on this issue, use your common sense. As Texans, we agree on a lot. You can't own a tank. We all agree on that. You cannot own a surface-to-air missile. We all agree on that. You want to live in a world where Ted Cruz owns a surface-to-air missile? I fucking don't. The guy lives in a flight path. Guess what else we all agree on? We all agree on violent history checks. And when I say all of us, I mean 95% of America, including 73% of the NRA. So don't let anyone tell you that we have no common ground here. We have a lot of common ground here. Let's start there and build out. Who's not going to vote for that guy?
Right, right. Well,
right?
I'm going to pull a name out of thin air and hope that Colin Elrod is listening to you right now, because he is the opponent against Ted Cruz. And I hope that he takes this advice so that you're talking to him, because I mean, you had such great advice. And I know we're running short on time, so we have one last question that we usually end the podcast, because it is intergenerational. And, you know, what is your advice to young people who might be thinking about going into writing, politics, communication? What do you have to say to them?
When I was a kid and going through college, I was an okay student. I wasn't an amazing student. If a subject inspired me, I was kind of the best person in the class. And if a subject didn't inspire me, I did enough not to embarrass myself. But then I got out in the real world, and I very quickly realized, you know, if I wanted to become a writer, sorry about that sound behind me, by the way. I very quickly realized I'm not more talented than the people I'm competing with. My only remedy is to outwork them. There are so many variables that will affect your ability to make a living, whatever field you go into. Health of our economy, the health of your particular industry. In my case, you know, did the DVD market flatten? Superhero movies become more important than anything else? Do studios merge, giving you less places where you can work? So many variables over which you have a little control. There's one variable over which you have control, which is your willingness to work. So you better maximize that variable. I'm up at 8 and I'm working, and I eat at 1 and I'm back at my desk at 1:15, and I go until 6, and I don't surf the web, and I don't try to find ex-girlfriends on Facebook. I don't do anything but work. And it's because there are mountaintops I'm trying to get to. I can see them from here, but I'm not there yet, and only work will get me there. And so I grind. I treat every single meeting I go into like it's an audition. I pretend, even if it's someone I've known for 20 years and I've made 2 movies with them, I pretend it's a meeting with someone I've never met before. And this is my chance to make a first impression. And that first impression should be, you're never going to meet a writer who is harder working, more collegial, more professional, more open to notes, and with less ego. I'm always selling in that way. And I can tell you that the people who listen to this, if they approach their work in that way, if they just pretend every single day that they are a machine and they are getting under the hood and doing their job, they'll be fine. Because if you were a mechanic, you wouldn't go to Starbucks for 2 hours and wait for your muse to land on your shoulder and say, fix the carburetor. You would just fix the carburetor. That's what we are. Screenwriters and mechanics. 95% of what we do is problem solving. And if you treat it like work, you'll never freeze.
Wow, that is amazing.
One of our most amazing episodes, and we had so many more questions that I hope that you will agree to come back. We want to
talk
AI
tomorrow
for sure. Well, we might. Sure. I mean, this is, we'll schedule something. There's,
you know,
just
what I'd love to talk
topic
about, because I just went through the Writers Guild strike and of course the SAG strike.
Yeah.
And in my business, we may have a Teamsters and IATSE strike. And I did a whole podcast about those strikes, and I would love to talk about the American labor movement and what it represents.
We had, that was our last section.
And not only that, but I have a personal interest because the strike was led by Fran Drescher, who in the early 2000s, I started watching The Nanny for the first time. And it made me so happy. I watched it right before bed, and I would go to bed laughing and happy. The double entendres, and I totally admired her as an actor and now as a union leader. And so we really have to have you back to talk about Fran Drescher and AI. So
let's do it.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. This was great.
It was a privilege. Thank you guys.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
And thanks for the tour of the Beverly Hills Club.
Yes. See you later. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Jill,
God, Victor, that was the best episode ever. I love Billy Ray. He is a genius. I want every Democratic candidate for any office to follow his advice. And just listening to this podcast will give people ideas about how to reach the audience, how to make them care, how to make them feel and understand. He's brilliant. He's just a great communicator.
And as he was saying all that stuff, if we had more time, I would have raised the fact that, you know, as I was listening to the State of the Union, one of the things I couldn't help but sort of notice is that President Biden did a lot of what he said in terms of reframing the conversation. I mean, he took issues that traditionally Republicans ran on and made it into an issue that appeals to all, you know, people. I mean, he reframed the immigration thing into safety and that this is, you know, appeals to freedom. And he reframed reproductive rights to freedom. And I just thought, you know, if we could get this sort of message out there, this podcast to as many people as possible, it's worth listening to. And I hope that he's advising as many candidates as he possibly can, but we need him to write a book. We need him to do something where it's just like regular lessons with Billy on communication. I mean, it's amazing.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing he said was like, oh my God, does he know that I have a hashtag that says say this, not that, when he was talking about don't call it insurrection because people don't get that, call it a crime. And it resonated. I'm going to post that on my hashtag, say this, not that, because I think that is true. People don't care. Insurrection. Oh, that's far away. Crime. Right. Oh, yeah. I'm afraid of crime. So he was brilliant. I hope everyone enjoys this episode as much as we did, and that they will suggest to other people that they listen to this episode and that they send it to their member of Congress who they want to get reelected.
Yes. And Billy has such a unique role into this because it does come from that sort of, as I was hearing him talk about how he transfers his writing in Hollywood and for filmmaking into politics. I mean, that sort of emotional, visceral reaction is not something that we see much from Democrats. And one of the things I've noticed just being in the sort of Democratic comm space is that when people send talking points, for instance, it's very much facts and figures. It's 62% of the country believes in this. It's, this is how much public support we have. And, that's all nice, but it doesn't appeal to emotions. It only appeals to, one's logic and one sense of reason. But if you want to convince people and get people to actually feel and absorb the thing, sort of like we were writing about for the State of the Union, you have to appeal to emotion and you have to appeal to, different frames and different narratives. And that's what I just heard from Billy last time when I was with him at the Jewish Deli and again today. And it's just incredible. So I hope everyone thinks long and hard about how they can change the frame and take on different emotions and narratives as they're crafting messages.
So one other thing I want to talk about before we close this episode is you are now back in Illinois. You have left UCLA. You have taken your last class. Your graduation ceremony is not till June, but you are officially a college graduate. We met when you had just graduated high school and the time really flew, but let's talk about and celebrate your finishing college.
Jill, we'll have to get a meal this week when do a proper celebration that we can post it on Twitter saying that we both got together. No, but it's so surreal. I mean, like you said, we met 4 years ago, literally. I think it was around this time I DM'd you on Twitter saying, we're both running to become delegates and would love to get to know you. And then we just started doing a podcast a few months later in June of 2020. So it's about to be 4 years of this podcast too. But, it feels surreal to say that I'm, no longer a student. I'm an alumni now. I'm in the real world, as they say. I don't know. It's all just so incredible. And I don't know. It's been a interesting 4 years from the pandemic to a continued pandemic. Once I got to college, it was masked and then Omicron hit in 2021, and that was another experience. And there was a huge strike at UCLA and the UC system, which then sent people to remote classes for the last few weeks of the quarter. And then every other thing from Ukraine war to the Middle East stuff. I mean, it's been a really crazy ride, but I'm glad to have survived. And I know a lot of my friends are also it's a bittersweet feeling, I think. And I don't know if you still feel that moment when you got done with school. It's sort of like, what do I do now with so much free time? No classes, no nothing really for the next week at least.
Well, we're going to put off the discussion about what's next for you until maybe next week. We'll have that discussion. Yes. But for now, I just wanted to say you were a stellar student. You were like, he was a straight A student, guys, literally for every single class. And in addition, he did this podcast and another podcast and appeared on MSNBC, all while being a really great student. So congratulations. You are a marvel and a model for all young students and for young voters. Follow Victor's advice and register and vote. Know what you're doing, pay attention, learn about the issues, pick one you really care about. That was advice from one of our other guests. Yes. Pick one issue you care about and learn what you need to know to persuade others to vote Democratic, because we're assuming most of our listeners are Democratic, but to vote the way you want them to vote based on the one thing that you are really passionate about. If you're really smart, like Victor, you can take on guns and climate and reproductive rights and whatever else you feel like, but at least one that you feel confident you could persuade others on.
And if I can quickly point out one thing to emphasize something about what Billy said at the end, you mentioned that I did well in my classes. I think part of the reason why I did, or the main reason why I did well in my classes, is because I chose something that I actually liked. I initially started off as a poli-sci major and I found it too boring, but I could have stuck to that route and attended these theoretical classes. But then I switched to a major that I actually really did like. And I feel like it didn't feel like work. I mean, as much as I hated writing some papers, at the end of the day, I liked what I was doing. And so it made the process more enjoyable. And I would say for anyone out there. I mean, the one thing that I would say is just, find a major that you like doing, and it makes it so much easier. It really does.
It's really interesting because I'm working on a children's
Yeah.
book right now, and it's sort of career advice.
Ooh.
And one of my points in the book is to follow your passion, to
Yeah.
do the thing that you really like, and to not, okay, you pick something your first year of college, and then you go, oh, that may not be the best thing for me. Try another. Don't be afraid to change. Take the challenge. So, yeah, I mean, again, Billy was great. I hope our audience liked it as much as you and I did,
Agreed.
and we'll recommend it to other people.
Yes. Thank you everyone for watching. We'll be back next week with another episode of iGen Politics. We hope you'll follow us wherever you follow your podcast, whether it's Apple, Google, Spotify, wherever you listen, we are there. Leave us a rating there as it helps others find this podcast as well, and it helps us tremendously. You can also watch us on YouTube, where you can also see hashtag Jill's pin, like the one that she's wearing today, which is a camera for Billy Ray. So watch us on YouTube.
Old-fashioned movie camera.
Movie camera,
Movie and
yes.
television, yeah.
Exactly. And we are at youtube.com/politicon, where you can like and subscribe us there and leave us a comment too. We love reading your comments. Thanks everyone for watching or listening, and we will see you next week. Thanks everyone.